Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, John DeLynn. It is May 8th, 2024, and we are here in the middle of a really important LDS discussion series on the Witnesses to the Book of Mormon. For those of you who don't know, the LDS discussion series is our best attempt at reviewing Mormon Church truth claims in a way that lets people decide for themselves how they feel about the validity of the church's truth claims. We have already done recently, we're like 50 plus episodes into this LDS discussion series, but we did one on the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon. Last time we did one on the eight witnesses to the Book of Mormon. Today we're going to cover other witnesses to the Book of Mormon beyond the three and the eight. And then we're actually now going to have a part four on Witnesses to the Book of Mormon, where we're going to talk about what became of the eight witnesses and the other witnesses to the Book of Mormon. Did they stay in the church? Did they not? Did they go on to follow other prophets or plates or not? And then finally, we're going to just talk about just general inconsistencies overall, sort of as a summary for all the witnesses, the three, the eight, and the other. So this is, again, part three of a four-part series on Book of Mormon witnesses. For those who want to check out the LDS discussion series, we want to make sure people understand that we believe these episodes are best viewed sequentially. So whether it's on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts or on the YouTube LDS discussions playlist that you can find on the Mormon Stories YouTube channel. We recommend you pause this episode, go back to the beginning, watch them all the way through, and that way you'll be fully informed when we, in this episode and others, refer to past episodes. But we know you guys really are valuing this series. This is all based on the amazing work of Mike from LDS Discussions. Mike, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, everybody.
We've also been having Nemo along, Nemo the Mormon from the Nemo the Mormon YouTube channel. Hi, Nemo.
Hi, everyone.
And to give Mike a break, we brought Julia Sanders on from Analyzing Mormonism on TikTok. She's been doing the research for these past few episodes and others. Julia, we're excited to have you back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
All right, so today we're going to cover other witnesses to the Book of Mormon beyond the three and the eight.
Yeah.
All right, should we dive in?
Yeah. I just want to say there's been a lot of people commenting that I talk really fast, and I do. And I wonder if that comes with having like 14 kids in the family. But I will try to do better, and I will try to slow down. So hopefully I can get better as we go.
Yeah. Well, you know, people think that I talk too slow and they listen to me on like 1.5 speed or 2 speed. Maybe when Julia is leading, you guys can use your YouTube settings or your podcast settings to slow it down to like 0.8 or 0.75.
But then, John, that will have you way too slow then.
I'll talk. Yeah. This. Anyway. All right, Julia. We know you're doing your best.
Okay. Perfect.
All right. Let's dive in.
Okay, so there are seven. I'm going to count seven. I don't know. A lot of people probably wouldn't count Lucy Harris, but I'm going to count her. So there are at least seven other witnesses to the gold plates. We have Josiah Stoll, who says he saw them. Emma Smith, and this is by feel. She's feeling them. And then Mary Musselman Whitmer. And then Lucy Mack Smith. William Smith by feel. And then Catherine Smith, his sister, also felt them. And then Lucy Harris, Martin Harris's wife, had a dream about the plates. So yeah, that's just the whole list. No, in no particular order.
Okay.
And I just want to point out again, and I've done this on all the other episodes as well, the sources that we are going to go over are by no means every source available on this topic. What I'm sharing are the sources that do not align with the testimony of the three and eight witnesses, or just showing the inconsistencies in general. So this is not all. There are more. I'm not showing all of them.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Okay. So the first one we're going to talk about is Josiah Stoll. Nemo, do you want to read this slide?
Sure. According to himself, this is Martha Campbell speaking in 1843. According to himself, Josiah Stoll was the very first person to ever see the plates. In a letter from Martha Campbell to Joseph Smith written on December the 19th, 1843, she wrote, "If I understood him right, he was the first person that took the plates out of your hands, the morning you brought them in. And he observed, blessed is he that seeth and believeth, and more blessed is he that believeth without seeing and says he has seen and believed. And breathe. Right. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so Josiah is saying that he was the first person to get the plates after Joseph brings them in. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, that's just an interesting thing. And I should also point out that Josiah Stoll was one of Joseph Smith's fellow treasure diggers. He was one of the ones that would hire Joseph Smith to peep, or to, I guess, to be a glass looker. So that's just a good background for Josiah.
But she says, this is a letter from Martha Campbell written to Joseph Smith, and it's important for the sake of, you know, covering everything. She is saying at the beginning, if I understood him right, he was the first one. So she's essentially seeking clarification from Joseph Smith. Do we know if he ever wrote her a letter in response, clarifying?
I tried to look this up, and I looked up, because the church on josephsmithpapers.org, it has all the things in Joseph Smith's handwriting, and there's no response letter to him, although he could have commissioned somebody else to write her a response. But as far as I know, he didn't respond to her, but I don't know. I could be wrong. But in this next one, so in the New England Christian Herald on November 7th of 1832, one of Joseph Smith's court trials was published in the summer of 1830. And in it, we learn more about Josiah Stoll's observation of the plates. Mike, do you want to read the little quote?
Yeah, it says, Smith, the prisoner, went in the night and brought the Bible, as Smith said. Witness saw a corner of it. It resembled a stone of a greenish cast. Should judge it to have been about 1 foot square and 6 inches thick. He would not let it be seen by anyone. The Lord had commanded him not. It was unknown to Smith that the witness saw a corner of the Bible, so called by Smith. Told the witness the leaves were of gold. There were written characters on the leaves.
Perfect. Okay, can you give a
context of the trial and what's going on here?
Sure. I think you'd know better, Mike. I feel like have you done episodes on this in the past?
We haven't done episodes, but I believe this was the trial where basically they were trying to get Joseph Smith and for being a glass looker. And if I remember correctly, this is the trial where Oliver Cowdery kind of goes in and gives a statement as to the translation process that I think is not what I would call honest. And it's one of those first instances where you can see Oliver Cowdery lying to protect, you know, Joseph Smith and the church.
And Josiah Stoll, he was the guy who brought Joseph and his dad down to Susquehanna, Pennsylvania area, to try and find the silver mine, right?
So Josiah Stoll was the one that led to the 1826 trial, and this is where his nephew saw through what Joseph Smith was doing and basically brought him to trial, and Josiah Stoll defended him at the trial. But it's also the trial where we got a perfect glimpse into how Joseph Smith was outright intentionally defrauding people. And that's why that Josiah Stoll is such an important figure, in my opinion, because Joseph Smith tells Josiah Stoll, I am being told by this guardian spirit that there's a feather buried deep within the treasure, right? And then the next day, would you not believe it, but Joseph Smith uncovers a feather in the ground. And Josiah Stoll is like, whoa, that dude, you've got the power. And as we talked about in our episode, feathers decompose in like weeks or months, which means there's no way in the world a feather is going to be preserved with gold, with ancient treasure, and survive. So the point is, Josiah Stoll is, I mean, not to be a jerk, but he's a very gullible person because he's believing stuff that is outright false, and his own nephew sees through it. But he defends him in the trial, and he's defending him here as well.
But I'm right that Stoll asked Joseph Smith Jr. and his dad to come down to Pennsylvania to help him find a silver mine, right?
I don't know what they were looking for, and I don't know if his dad was there, but he did pay him to bring him there.
I know that. Okay, and that's how Joseph meets Isaac Hale and Emma Hale, because while he's trying to do the dig with Josiah Stoll, they board at Isaac Hale's house, right?
I get Willard Chase and the treasure diggers mixed up. But there, was it him that came down to get Emma's furniture, and he saw the Isaac and Joseph talking, and Joseph admitted that he never saw anything through the stone? Was that with Josiah? I can't remember.
That would be Isaac Hale.
Yeah. Well, who was the one witnessing that?
Oh, right, right, right. Yeah.
I think it was, but I get my early characters mixed up.
Okay. So. All right. I'm just trying to understand the context of what's going on here. I'm pretty sure that what I said is right about Josiah Stoll. Okay.
Okay. So there are some problems with this testimony. So Joseph had said that if anyone was to look upon the plates, Joseph would be destroyed, yet he was not. Stoll described the plates as being greenish, yet no one else describes them this way. And also, Mike, as you were reading it, he describes it as being 1 foot square inch, 1 foot square and 6 inches thick, which is a size that none of the other witnesses describe it as being. And Joseph Smith seemed to be unaware that Stoll saw the plates, which is also really interesting. And Stoll had to be told that the leaves were gold and that there were characters written on them. So there's a lot of problems to me. Do you guys have thoughts?
Yeah. I'm just showing this is 1 foot by 1 foot for the audio listeners. I'm holding a 12-inch rule in front of my face, which is much bigger than other people would report
it to be.
The
8x4. Or the 8x6, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest one is that Joseph would be destroyed, and he wasn't. Like, Joseph laid out there a very clear benchmark. If someone looks on these plates that isn't meant to, then I get destroyed. And he didn't know that a witness had seen the plates. So, I mean, but what would he have done? If someone saw the plates, even his, like, prop set that wasn't meant to, like, he's not going to kill himself to complete the ruse. So what does he do there? He's going to have to pivot and try and make a way in which, the Lord has spared me this time, but X, Y, Z.
Right. And then, like, I put in the couple of revelations that we've talked about in the past, where the Lord gives him the instruction not to let anyone see it, or else he could be destroyed. And so I added those two in here, just like, what's happening here? Like, why was Josiah able to see it? Should we read these just for context? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mike, do you want to read this one?
Yeah. So this is DNC 5, and it says, "Behold, I say unto you that my servant hath desired a witness, that my servant Joseph hath got the things which he hath testified that he hath got. And now behold, thus say ye unto him, I, the Lord, am God. I have given these things unto him, and I have commanded him that he should stand as a witness of these things. Nevertheless, I have caused him that he should enter into a covenant with me, that he should not show them except I command him."
God doesn't like punctuation. Not to be glib.
He didn't in the Book of Mormon either.
Right. Yeah. So with that one, I guess, because the Lord's saying, I'm covenanting to you that you don't show this to anybody. Joseph didn't show it to Josiah. Josiah just happened to see it. But in this next one, John, do you want to read this next one right here? It's from the history of the church.
Okay. In the history of the church, Joseph Smith recorded that, "Again, he, the Lord, told me that when I got the plates of which he had spoken for the time that they should be obtained was not yet fulfilled, I should not show them to any person, neither the breastplate with the Urim and Thummim, only to those to whom I should be commanded to show them. If I did, I should be destroyed."
Okay, so it's the argument that it's passive. Someone's passively seen them, so it didn't show them. Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. I think that's the only way out of that one. No, you're fine.
Your thunder there.
No, you're totally fine. Yeah, because he's not showing them to Josiah specifically. He just happens to see them. But I also have problems. There's also problems there because the size is different and the color is different than what all the rest of the witnesses are saying. So there's a lot of problems with Josiah's witness, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, just really quickly, what we just read, it just seems so convenient. If I'm just trying to look at the story through neutral eyes, having been raised Mormon and having never thought about this more neutrally, it just seems so convenient that there's a question as to an angel really delivered plates to Joseph. There's a decent chance he didn't, because that's not how the world works. However, isn't it convenient that the Lord then gives a revelation commanding him not to show them to anyone, or he'll be destroyed? That just seems weird, because the Lord could show them to everyone. I think we covered this last time. The Lord could show them to everyone if he wanted to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it seems more like a cover. It's more likely a cover, an excuse so that Joseph doesn't have to produce plates that probably don't exist. It seems more likely to be that than God really making commandments about who can and can't see them.
And unless we believe in the idea that, you know, faith is necessary, and, you know, that's where that argument will go, is like, people have to have faith so they can't see them because they have to believe in things that they can't see, et cetera, right? That's where that argument would go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it feels like early Mormon apologetics because that's written in 1837, right? I think it's 37 and 38. And it's almost like Joseph Smith is trying to answer the problems he knows he's created in there. And by saying like, well, yeah, I would have shown more people, but God would have destroyed me. So that's not in the earlier revelation in that direct way. So it almost feels like Joseph Smith is trying to get out ahead of the fact that there's a lot of holes in his story. And it's like he's trying to plug them up as he's rewriting his own history. That's just something that catches my thought.
Yeah, that's a good point. So the first slide, it shows, can you just put it up for a second? So this is the revelation, this one here. The revelation was given in March of 1829. And so what Mike is saying is that then in the history of the church, which you said was 38, right? From here?
Yeah, it's like 37, 38. He's adding in.
Yeah, so he's saying Joseph's adding in that he would be destroyed. Whereas before he just says, you know, you're not supposed to show them to anyone.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just interesting.
Okay, all right. Yeah. So what do we make anything of Josiah Stoll? Is it just possible that he was inserting himself into a story, but was just making stuff up or had a bad memory? Like, I don't know what to make of Josiah Stoll.
I don't know. Cause that letter, I'm sorry. Can you put it back up again? I can't remember what day when the letter was published to Joseph. It must've been later. Okay. So yeah. 40. So I guess the letter happens with this account. 1843 is when he says he was the first to see it, but then also in when the trial, Joseph would have heard him give his testimony. I don't know. I don't know what to make of his, it just seems super inconsistent with the rest of the witnesses.
Just to be clear as well, that letter isn't Josiah Stoll saying anything. That's right. Martha Campbell saying, Josiah Stoll told me this. Told me. Am I understanding it correctly, Joseph? And we don't know whether Joseph said, yes, you are understanding it correctly, or no, you're not. So
I guess maybe as I'm thinking this through, the church doesn't claim Josiah Stoll to be an important witness for the Book of Mormon. So if he turns out not to be credible, it kind of doesn't relate to the church's truth claims because they're not claiming him to begin with, right?
They're claiming him in a small way. Like they'll say, oh, these few people happen to see or handle the plates or whatever.
Yeah.
Like they'll kind of mention him briefly, but as far as which of the witnesses, which of the other is most important, I think they hold up Mary Whitmer and Emma Smith as being kind of the most important ones, in my opinion, from what I've seen.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's fair.
Okay.
I think it's also interesting. And just to be quick about this, I've mentioned this a lot in previous episodes, but it's always funny how when Joseph Smith is in control of a situation, he can really control the details. This one he has no control over because Josiah still claims to see it. It's in the court record. And it vastly is different than what Joseph Smith is going to present to the other witnesses. And so I have no idea what Josiah Stoll saw. I think he was a very gullible victim of Joseph Smith. He was involved in all this treasure digging stuff. But I do think the fact that his details differ just shows that what happens when Joseph Smith is not in control of leading you through what you're seeing versus when he is.
Okay. Well, and then the part about him having a bad memory, the trial, the court records came out in the 1830s. So I don't know how much he could have forgotten. I mean, I guess Joseph obtained the plates in 27 and it was a few years later, but anyway.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So the next one is Emma Hale Smith. And so this, as far as I know, what we're seeing here is all that we have from Emma seeing the plates.
So this is Joseph's wife for those who aren't Mormon.
Yeah. So in an interview that was published in the Saints Herald on October 1st of 1879, just 5 months after Emma had passed away, Emma made these statements. And so this is a question and answer. Do two of you want to kind of play?
I'll question you, Julia. Do you want to answer?
Sure.
Let's do that. Are you sure that he had the plates at the time you were writing for him?
The plates often lay on the table without any attempt at concealment, wrapped in a small linen tablecloth, which I had given him to fold them in. I once felt the plates as they thus lay on the table, tracing their outline and shape. They seemed to be pliable like thick paper, and would rustle with a metallic sound when the edges were moved by the thumb, as one does sometimes thumb the edges of a book.
Could not Joseph Smith have dictated the Book of Mormon to you, Oliver Cowdery, and the others who wrote for him after having first written it or having first read it out of some book?
Joseph Smith could neither write nor dictate a coherent and well-worded letter, let alone dictating a book like the Book of Mormon. And though I was an active participant in the scenes that transpired and was present during the translation of the plates, and had cognizance of things as they transpired, it is marvelous to me, a marvel and a wonder, as much as to anyone else.
I should suppose that you would have uncovered the plates and examined them.
I did not attempt to handle the plates, other than I have told you, nor uncover them to look at them. I was satisfied that it was the work of God, and therefore did not feel it to be necessary to do so.
Major Bideman here suggested, did Mr. Smith forbid you examining the plates?
I do not think he did. I knew he had them and was not especially curious about them. I moved them from place to place on the table as it was necessary in doing my work.
This is really important stuff. Go on, Julia, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, actually, if you can put it up so I can just see and kind of go through it. So I just want to note that her new husband, Biteman, is in the room when she's having this interview. And it's just really interesting. Like, I highlighted a few things because so she's moving them around. The thickness, like we talked about last time, doesn't make sense because to have engravings on both sides would make the paper, like she's describing thin paper. They've wrestled with metallic sounds. You can thumb it. Like, John, you have the plates in your office that are tin. I think they're tin and they don't rustle. They're very heavy. They're very sharp. They don't bend. They're not pliable and things like that. And also I highlighted the part where she says Joseph couldn't write a coherent and well-worded letter. Somebody, I don't remember who it was, but somebody published the letters between Joseph and Emma. And if you've read any of his letters, they are coherent and they are well-worded. They're not punctuated well. He doesn't spell well because the spelling wasn't set spelling.
Standardized
spelling. Mm-hmm. And so like you'll see those things, but like Joseph could write a well-worded coherent letter. But what were you guys' other thoughts? There's so much in there.
He definitely could dictate a letter, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, he could dictate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that seemed weird.
We covered that in our earlier episode, the letter he wrote to her in like 1829, and it mm-hmm. reads pretty good. It actually, you know, if you compare it to the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon, it reads just as good. You know, because the original Book of Mormon manuscript, for those who have not watched the earlier episodes, does not read like it does today. It's heavily edited now. It's got punctuation. It's got all sorts of ways to make it sound a lot more elegant than it would have sounded at the time. And so that statement tells you right off the bat that Emma Smith is working hard to make Joseph Smith seem more and more miraculous by giving us a claim that he couldn't do something that we have evidence he did in those letters to her in 1829.
And that's really, really important because a lot of apologetic arguments based around the idea of Joseph Smith being uneducated, and that's the miraculous nature of the Book of Mormon, is that he couldn't have written such a thing when actually we know he could write. He wasn't illiterate. Like, some people will try and claim Joseph Smith to be illiterate, which is just not the case. And we have physical evidence. And I mean, the church has printed evidence to the contrary, right? The church has printed letters written by Joseph Smith's own hand.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Joseph Smith papers is, no?
Right.
Yeah, I think
And then I just want to say about the education of Joseph Smith really fast. William Davis has done a lot of research about the education of Joseph Smith, and you've interviewed him on Mormon Stories. And recently, Colby Townsend published this book, and it has a lot of William Davis's research in it about how educated Joseph was. So if you want to learn about that, then maybe go to those resources.
Because William Davis has visions in a sea of stone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So as far as Emma's testimony goes, Emma's important because she was married to Joseph. She's one of the early, I don't know, co-founders of the church in a way. Mm-hmm. The church needs her, testimony about Joseph just to make him look like a decent guy. What is there anything problematic about this account as it relates to the church's truth claims or the veracity of Joseph's story?
As like troublesome things like the, I don't know, I guess some of this, I'm looking at the specifics of what she's saying. Do you guys have thoughts?
Well, I mean, the major thing there is her claims about Joseph Smith's abilities, I think, are really detrimental to the church's truth claims and the claims about the nature of the translation process and how Joseph Smith did or didn't
do it. During this time, there are other witnesses that were talking specifically about the Solomon Spaulding manuscript. And even though she doesn't say it, I think that's exactly what she's trying to hit specifically.
100%.
Right. Because I can't remember if it was William or some of the other witnesses were talking. They're like, no, he did not use the Solomon Spaulding manuscript. And anyway, so I think that's what she's trying to
That's it, 100%. Because she says, keep with the slide. She actually specifically says no nor script, right? So, you know, she's basically trying to get ahead of the fact that there's the Spaulding rumor out there. And in no way is she saying, like we talked about this in our earlier episodes, that's not her saying Joseph Smith didn't use the Bible. It's her saying he wasn't using a manuscript that he was copying from. And that is a direct kind of attack on that Spaulding manuscript theory that had been out there at the time. So yeah, that's what she's referring to 100%.
So as far as like, if whether these sources support or don't support the church's claims, not every source that I'm putting up here is against what the church is trying to say. What I'm trying to show is just what I can show and just show that it's not all consistent. There are things that are different. like the thickness, her downplaying his education. She was like, oh, I don't remember if Joseph Smith told me not to see the plates. Whereas with all of his family members, he says specifically, do not see these. You cannot look at these plates. So I don't know if she's trying to downplay that as well, or if she just can't remember. So there's little things in there that I don't, that I wonder at.
And the thing, he's not especially curious about them. She moved them around as was necessary to do the work. That phrase there is really interesting because it very much lends itself to this idea of the see a stone in a hat, which we're now kind of accepting as the dominant narrative, which the church hid for a long time.
Something
that doesn't seem realistic to me is the idea that these are supposed to be golden plates delivered by angels. They're sitting around the cabin covered by a cloth. Emma's literally dusting and cleaning around them, moving them, but she never once tried to peek at them. I mean, I guess if she thought she would be destroyed by looking at them.
Or Joseph would be destroyed.
Right. But it seems hard to believe that she didn't peek at them.
And also that they're just on the table in her way, that they're not in some sort of spot where they can stay at, do you know what I mean? Like they're not secure. They've not been put
hidden under the hearth or hidden in the barrel of beans or wherever else they hide them. They're just sitting open.
They're out on the table and in her way.
Which then makes from a conspirator in the story, or is she totally being duped? And it's hard for me to, I wouldn't know.
By 1879, you know, what do they say? That was 5 months after she died that was published. But this is like a late life account. I think my feeling about Emma, and this is just my feeling, is that by the end of her life, she was trying to defend her husband's legacy. And it was very traumatic for her. And she's gone through all these experiences with Joseph. And she's just trying to defend her husband's memory. Of him that she keeps hold of in her head because he's died. Yep. She's just trying to keep that sacred.
Yeah, and we know that specifically with polygamy. Oh, sorry. We just know that specifically with Emma denying polygamy. No, Joseph Smith never lived polygamy. Her sons were raised, or her children are raised, thinking that he was never a polygamist. Mm-hmm. And then they find out later that Joseph Smith III, that they all find out that he was a polygamist. Mm-hmm. So she was trying to. Yeah.
We know that Emma knew. So you have to ask, why would she deny it? And I think that's where I come to with that, is that she's trying to defend her husband's memory, even just to herself.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's a legacy issue where she's trying to defend Joseph's legacy, because let's be honest, that reflects on her kids, her grandkids, her entire, the posterity of Joseph Smith's family relies on Joseph Smith being looked at as a prophet and not as a charlatan. And so this statement to me doesn't come off to me as someone who's trying to engage in a conspiracy as much as someone who's trying to make the best of what she's got to deal with. And to Nemo's point, the idea that she is just like, oh yeah, these were just on the table, that to me is really damning, because if that's true, as I mentioned in the last episode, the fact that Joseph Smith then couldn't bring other people in to look at for the eight witnesses, couldn't bring people who are skeptical of him, is even more damning, because those plates were just sitting there, they're not secured. So why couldn't Joseph Smith have brought a reporter in when it was time for the eight witnesses? But I know we covered that in the last episode, but her statement has so many problems. You could do a whole episode on it, but I do believe it's her, as Nemo said, trying to shape and define Joseph Smith's legacy more than anything else.
Yeah, you got friends over for dinner and you're like, hold on, guys, I can't let you in. I've just got to go get the sacred ancient records off the table first. You know, like, that's how in the way they are. Anyway.
Okay, cool. All right. So who's, I guess, going to the next one, right, Julia? Tell us who Mary Whitmer is really quick.
Yeah, so Mary Whitmer is the mother of the majority of the eight witnesses, I should say. Like, she's the mother of David Whitmer, who is one of the three witnesses, Christian, Peter Whitmer Jr. I can't remember all the other the Whitmers that were witnesses, but she's the mother figure. And so here she's, for a while, Joseph Smith removes himself to where they live, and that's where they finish the translation of the plates. And so she now has Joseph living there. She has Emma there. I think she has Oliver Cowdery even there, and I can't remember who else. But so she has more mouths to feed. She has more chores to do and things like that. And so she's, in this moment, she's really overwhelmed. But also, I should say that the Whitmers believed in seer stones. They believed in divining rods. They all come from this magic view, this magic worldview. And so that's where she's coming from as well. So this is, I don't know if that's enough for her background, but
that's great.
Okay. So in November of 1878, the Deseret News published an interview that Joseph F. Smith and Orson Pratt had with David Whitmer. This is the first instance of the story of Mary Whitmer being published. Part of the story reads, Sometime after this, my mother was going to milk the cows. When she was met out near the yard by the same old man, judging by her description of him, and we'll talk about the old man in a second, who said to her, "You have been very faithful and diligent in your labors, but you are tried because of the increase of your toil. It is proper, therefore, that you should receive a witness, that your faith may be strengthened." Therefore, he showed her the plates. My father and mother had a large family of their own. The addition to it, therefore, of Joseph, his wife Emma, and Oliver, very greatly increased the toil and anxiety of my mother. And although she never complained, she had sometimes felt that her labor was too much, or at least she was perhaps beginning to feel so. This circumstance, however, completely removed all such feelings and nerved her up for her increased responsibilities. And so that's the story of Mary Whitmer. And then we'll talk about it some more. But I just wanted to say that the old man that David is referencing here comes from earlier in the interview when he and Oliver and Joseph passed an old man on the way to the Whitmer home. The man said that he was heading to Camorra, which David Whitmer couldn't understand at the time. He didn't know what Camorra was. David described the man as being quote, "about 5 feet, 8 or 9 inches tall, and heavy set. About such a man as Jesse Van Cleve. There, I guess he's sitting next to this man. But heavier, his face was large. He was dressed in a suit of brown woolen clothes. His hair and beard were white like Brother Pratt's, but his beard was not so heavy. David feels certain that the old man was Moroni, despite Mary Whitmer always calling him, quote, Brother Nephi. If it was indeed Moroni, why did Joseph never describe Moroni that way? Can resurrected beings change the way they look? So I just think there's problems with that. That whole thing confuses me.
Can somebody restate what we just read, just in common terms? What did we just read?
So Mary's doing chores, and then an old man comes to her, and he's like, "Hey, because you're kind of stressed out because you're having to do all these things."
This is a random old man,
random heavy set guy, random guy, brown clothes. He's like, "Hey, I'm going to show you the plates." I guess he says, "My name's Brother Nephi, and I'm going to show you the plates." So he sits down with her. And he's showing her the plates. And then we have more details later in different interviews. And so once she sees the plates, she's like, "Okay, now I feel like I can do my chores better because I know," like, I guess she's more converted to the cause and things like that. And then with David, going backwards, when Joseph Smith was going to the Whitmer's house, he traveled with David and Oliver, and they passed an old man, same old man, brown clothes, heavier set guy. And they're like, "Oh, do you want to ride?" And he's like, "Well, no, I'm going to Camorra." And there, David Whitmer looks at Joseph and he's like, "What is that?" And they said, Joseph looked like white as a sheet. And they're like, "What's happening?" And Joseph's like, "That's the angel Moroni. And in his pack is a set of gold plates." And so then David's claiming that his mother later saw the same old man with a brown suit and the same knapsack.
So Mike, what do you make of that story?
It doesn't show for 50 years. So to me, you know, we talked about the transfiguration of Brigham Young in that episode and how in 10 years it went from the most ordinary event to the most miraculous event in modern history. And now we have the same situation where 50 years later, a story is being told on someone else's behalf and it doesn't add up. It was never mentioned contemporaneously. And so to me, I look at that and I just go, the church uses it as faith promoting because it sounds awesome. But from like a skeptical point of view, I'm like, 50 years and no one mentioned this? I don't think so. But that's just me.
Right. And then like just the description of Moroni or Nephi, that's confusing too. Just the switching of who this person is. But then like, if it is Moroni, Joseph said it was Moroni. Why does Moroni look this way when all of his other accounts say that he looked different? I'm confused by that too. And then, yeah, the fact that it comes later is problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. There's a number of those stories in church history that are like, what's the one where Snow sees Jesus in the temple, right? And his granddaughter tells it like long after. And so it's this faith promoting story about how Jesus was in the temple with it was Erastus Snow, right? Or Lorenzo, I can't remember who it was.
Lorenzo
Snow. Anyways, it's being told from somebody so long after the fact. And she was a little kid at the time when it supposedly happened. And so, you know, from, again, we've talked about this a lot. If you tell people that are in the Mormon church the story and you give them the details without telling them it's Mormonism, they're like, yeah, it's made up because it's clearly got problems. But at the same time, I mean, who's to say we weren't there? So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So clearly the Whitmers were kind of weird and kooky anyway. So we would expect there to be weird, kooky stories. It does maybe at minimum, it calls into question just the credibility of the Whitmer family in general. I don't know.
Well, I mean, they're from a magical worldview. So for me, it's not even that surprising they would believe in having visions. It's just, I believe in this particular one, it probably would have been documented somewhere earlier that this had happened. I mean, you know, there's a lot of value in having these visions that can back up the credibility of Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon. So I just, that's where I'm kind of confused. It's like, how would this story, which would be one of the biggest miracles of that time, just go unspoken until after she's dead and unable to tell it herself? But that, like I said, that's where I'm coming from on that one.
I think I just get hung up on the old man, because like with the three witnesses, Martin Harris had to retreat because whatever was happening within him, lack of faith or something like that, he had to retreat. And only then did the angel appear in his glory. And then Mary Whitmer is able to see this man in her barn, and he shows her the plates.
Yeah. There's these ideas that people have to go through sufficient amounts of mortification of the flesh and these spiritual preparations in order to have these divine experiences and visitations. And then at the same time, angels are just knocking about on the road, saying hi to people as they go, you know?
Right.
Go ahead.
No, you go.
I was just going to say, do you remember when we talked about Joseph Smith getting the plates? Emma comes with them. They have to do all of this crazy stuff. Like, don't they have to like dress in black and all this like magical stuff? He gets the plates and she has to stand with her back turned to him the entire time so that she can't see anything. And so you kind of look at that compared to what, you know, is going on with Mary Whitmer. And it's just like, this doesn't make sense to me. Like it certainly doesn't feel consistent whatsoever. But then again, you know, none of this really does.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. What's next, Julia?
Okay, so there's four times where this story is told with Mary Whitmer, and this one gives more details. I don't know if we should just go over them. Nemo, do you want to read this one?
Absolutely, that's fine. Okay. John C. Whitmer, son of John Whitmer, one of the eight witnesses, once stated, "I have heard my grandmother, Mary M. Whitmer, say on several occasions that she was shown the plates of the Book of Mormon by a holy angel, whom she always called Brother Nephi. She undoubtedly refers to Moroni, the angel who had the plates in charge. It was at the time, she said, when the translation was going on at the house of the elder Peter Whitmer, her husband, Joseph Smith, and his wife, and Oliver Cowdery, whom David Whitmer, a short time previous, had brought up from Harmony, Pennsylvania, were all boarding with the Whitmers, and my grandmother, in having so many extra persons to care for, besides her own large household, was often overloaded with work to such an extent that she felt it to be quite a burden. One evening, when after having done her usual day's work in the house, she went to the barn to milk the cows, she met a stranger carrying something on his back that looked like a knapsack. At first she was a little afraid of him, but when he spoke to her in a kind, friendly tone and began to explain to her the nature of the work which was going on in her house, she was filled with inexpressible joy and satisfaction. He then untied his knapsack and showed her a bundle of plates, which in size and appearance corresponded with the description subsequently given by the witnesses of the Book of Mormon. This strange person turned the leaves of the Book of Plates over, leaf after leaf, and also showed her the engravings upon them, after which we hold her to be patient and faithful in bearing her burden a little longer. That should be, he told her, probably, promising that if she would do so, she should be blessed and her reward would be sure, if she proved faithful to the end. The personage then suddenly vanished with the plates, and where he went, she could not tell. From that moment, my grandmother was enabled to perform her household duties with comparative ease, and she felt no more inclination to murmur because her lot was hard. I knew my grandmother to be good, noble, and truthful woman, and I have not the least doubt of her statement in regard to seeing the plates being strictly true. She was a strong believer in the Book of Mormon until the day of her death." Now, I just want to point out that someone having a visitation of an angel that gets them to stop murmuring isn't always the most effective tactic, because Nephi's brothers would then go on to continue to murmur after a short while. So, you know, she's lucky that this stuck with her for a long time.
Well, it didn't keep her in the church, though. But
so maybe it didn't work after all.
So here, John, if you'll throw that back up.
But you see that parallel there, right? With the with Laman and Lemuel, that's clearly with the use of the word murmuring and all that stuff.
Okay, so this one's so this is just a few years later. So the other one was 78, and the second time, or then another time, the story is told in, is in 88. So there's more details in this. He unties the knapsack. He shows her plate after plate, or leaf after leaf. And also, I think the part where her grandson says that the personage suddenly vanished, I thought that was interesting. And then he's reiterating that she never denied her testimony of the Book of Mormon, which, you know, that's one of the things the church says. But just because you don't deny your testimony doesn't mean that you actually experienced these things. Also, that's interesting to me because I think he references this is a story that she's told often, but why then, if she's telling it often and she sees the plates in 1829, why are we only hearing about this until the late 1800s? Like, why the church had their own publication. She could have written it down. Yeah. There's a pattern with Mormonism where they don't write important events down until way later. And we'll see this throughout these eight witnesses.
First vision, priesthood restoration,
right. Transfiguration of Brigham Young. Yeah, I mean, that this to me, I just keep thinking Transfiguration of Brigham Young, where you have just an ordinary event that turns into a miracle. And then as it gets told, the people who are telling it later take those original miracle details, they add on, grander and grander it gets. And then at the end, the angel, like Bilbo Baggins, the Lord of the Rings, put the ring on, just vanishes. It's just so... It's goofy to me. It's just all I can think of when you're reading that is, you know, if you have seen Lord of the Rings or read it, I guess, but I just picture in the movie where Bilbo Baggins puts the ring on, he disappears, and the whole party's like, whoa, you know, that's like the angel doing magic tricks for everybody. It's just, it's so comical sometimes when you read this stuff, because from, you know, knowing the details about the other stuff, you just go, yeah, I could see where they're going, but no, this doesn't add up.
Yeah. It's just interesting that it's just so late. So Mary Whitmer's story was also published in the Latter-day Saint Biographical Encyclopedia 4 years later, and it uses the exact same language that we just read. And then the Whitmer family also has their own family version of it. Mike, do you want to read this version?
Yeah, so this is being told by Mary's granddaughter in 1958. So now we're talking like 130 years later. Grandma stopped telling a story of Mother Whitmer till 1900 when B.H. Roberts printed it in his New Witness for God. Then she said, I'm so glad I could tell it again. David Whitmer had invited Joseph and Oliver to live in his father's home while translating the Book of Mormon. When Oliver's hand and Joseph's eye grew tired, they went to the woods for a rest. There they often skated rocks on a pond. Mary Whitmer, with five grown sons and a husband to care for, besides visitors, often grew tired. She thought they might just as well carry her a bucket of water or chop a bit of wood as to skate rocks on a pond. She was about to order them out of her home. One morning, just at daybreak, she came out of her cow stable with two full buckets of milk in her hands when a short, heavy-set, gray-haired man carrying a package met her and said, My name is Moroni. You have become pretty tired with all the extra work you have to do. The Lord has given me permission to show you this record, turning the gold leaves one by one.
Thank you. I mean,
if he came up and said, My name is Moroni, why did she keep calling him Nephi?
Right. And then you see from David Whitmer where she's like, oh, even though she says Nephi, she obviously means Moroni. And so like they're
clearly
trying to make it fit. Mm. Another thing I liked about this one, through this slide, is that it's showing even though Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery are engaged in the translation process, they have time to, she says that they often skated rocks on the pond and they're just out. They're just kind of hanging around. And she's frustrated because she's doing all this work and she's doing like all the things, all the other chores. And I just think that's interesting is that why did they take breaks so often? Or like, why, like, I don't know. I think Dan Vogel has talked about the timing of it, of them. Like, why did it take them so long to translate and things like that? Anyway.
Yeah. I always grew up believing that Joseph Smith was a hardworking family man who would beat rugs and give kids marriage advice and stuff. You know what I mean? He was always engaged in the menial tasks of the household. That's what I grew up believing about Joseph Smith. So to find out that actually during which time he wasn't going down and helping out the woman who was kind of letting him stay in her home, but instead he was going out to the pond with his mate and skipping rocks. Like,
well, even with the treasure digging, like the church tries to depict him as a hardworking, like farm hand. And like in one of their main videos, you see him walking with a shovel on his shoulder, but the witnesses for the, for the treasure digging, they said he actually didn't do any digging. He just looked in his stone and a hat, and he just basically just told them what to do. And so, so Joseph, as a hardworking man, might not be super accurate.
But yeah, it might not be. It's just.
Yeah, different types of work too.
Yeah. So Mary's story of seeing the golden plates while working in the barn has been recorded multiple times and is shared often by the church to promote the literal existence of the plates. And so it appears only four times, 1958, and then it goes to 1901, 1886. And then, like I said, the first time it was published, the first time it was published was in 1878, and that was 49 years after the event would have taken place. And then 20 years after she had passed away. So again, it's a very late coming source.
Can I just explain to the listening audience why I laughed at that? On this slide, there is a picture from the church website. It's a picture of gold plates on a table. And it says, that moment in the barn is one she'll never forget. And that did the rounds in the Mormon zeitgeist on the internet for a while when that first came out. I believe the church changed the title of the article afterwards because everyone's thoughts instantly went to Fanny Alger, who Joseph Smith famously was found copulating with in the barn. It was an unfortunate title. It's almost as unfortunate as that BYU one where it talks about filling the holes left by becoming non-married after marriage.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Filling the holes left by sex or something like that. It was pretty bad.
It was bad. Yeah.
The church has had some humdingers in its time.
I haven't seen that one. That's interesting.
Sorry, John, I lowered the tone there.
No worries.
They'll let you pick it back up.
So the point you're making about this slide is that Mary Whitmer is not a very reliable witness.
I wouldn't say immediately that because something is a late source, it's false. But I think the events surrounding it, for instance, Joseph Smith's first vision, Joseph Smith saying it late doesn't necessarily mean that it's false. But looking at the Palmyra revivals, looking at when the preachers came in and when he had access to them and all the things around Joseph's life, like the first vision, there's no record of it happening. Or even with the priesthood restoration, it's a late said source. And nobody remembers it. Like even some of the 12 apostles were like, Joseph never talked about the angels or anything like that. And so the fact that it's late doesn't mean it's false, but I just want to point out it is a very late. So And then like just the inconsistencies with who's showing her the plates, who is Angel Moroni, what does it look like? And I just have questions. I guess I'm just trying to point out that the water for this is very muddy for the witnesses.
And I would put it a different way and just say, if this was a person that was saying they were around Joseph Smith and he was making it up and doing stuff, and it was the same timeline, every person that worked within the church or apologetic arms of the church would say, this story is absolute crap. Look at the timing of when it appeared and how it changes over those next, 80 years. So to Julia's point, the fact that it's late doesn't mean it's not true. The problem is that we have all of this other context around it, all of these opportunities for her to tell her story. She doesn't do it. And then it's being told by someone else. It's almost worse. Like, if I experience something at the age of, let's just say 20, and then when I'm 75, I'm telling a story to my grandchild, it's already a little sketchy because that's 55 years removed, but at least I'm telling it. This story is now being told through other people looking to promote the church. There's a lot of issues with it. And like I said, if it was the other way around, apologists would be like, this is so far. So not only is it far removed, but it's secondhand. And so just read Fair Mormon about secondhand sources and then compare it to this and you'll go, that's why this is problematic.
Right. And then we'll see a lot of that in these later sources, specifically with Catherine Smith and the problems with her testimonies. Okay, so next we're going to talk about Lucy, and I find this super interesting. So so Reverend Henry Caswell published a book in 1842 called The City of the Mormons, or 3 Days at Nauvoo, in which he interviewed Lucy Mack Smith. He had gone to her house to see the mummies. And these are the mummies that they got from, what's his name?
Chandler.
Chandler, yeah. They got these mummies from Chandler. I think there was 4 mummies, right? And then, so she's displaying them at her house and she's charging 25 cents, which is probably the equivalent to around $9 for us today in 2024. But anyway, so she says, I have myself seen and handled the golden plates, and they are about 8 inches long and 6 wide. Some of them are sealed together and are not to be opened. And some of them are loose. They are all connected by a ring, which passes through a hole at the end of each plate, and are covered with letters beautifully engraved. I have seen and felt also the Urim and Thummim, which resembled 2 large bright diamonds set in a bow like a pair of spectacles. My son puts these over his eyes when he reads unknown languages. And so she's scrubbing out the seer stone, it seems. And they enable him to interpret them in English. I have likewise carried in my hands the sacred breastplate. It is composed of pure gold, and it is made to fit the breast very exactly. And then one thing I think
breast?
Is, yeah, so there's other descriptions of this where it's like she's describing these things as being very, very huge. And so there's now theories that the Jaredites were large. They were almost giants. And so that's another thing that I think was interesting. So according to Henry Caswell, Lucy Mack Smith is claiming to have seen the golden plates. However, the following paragraph in Caswell's book is very noteworthy. John, do you want to go ahead and read this paragraph?
Yeah. While the old woman was thus delivering herself, I fixed my eyes steadily upon her. She faltered and seemed unwilling to meet my glance, but gradually recovered her self-possession. The melancholy thought entered my mind that this poor old creature was not simply a dupe of her son's knavery, but that she had taken an active part in the deception.
So I just thought that was really interesting. So even though Lucy's standing here telling him, hey, I've seen the plates, he doesn't believe her. He thinks that she's just an active part of this lie or the deception. And so one thing that I want to point out is that the church, so like you, John, you were talking about which ones the church says. So this is from the church's website. This is from the page called Who Saw the Golden Plates besides Joseph Smith. And here you'll see on the screen that there's the photo of Mary Whitmer. And then they list off the witnesses and where the arrow is pointing. You see Josiah Stoll. He says he glimpses a corner of the plates. And then it says, and at least four others lifted the gold plates. And then it says that there was Lucy Mack Smith, Emma Smith, William Smith, and Catherine Smith. So they're not claiming, the church doesn't seem to be claiming that Lucy saw the plates. They're just saying that she lifted them. And so that's just interesting to me if you're trying to connect that with Henry Caswell. And then one thing that I wanted to point out too is in her autobiography, Joseph Smith, the Prophet and His Progenitors, published in 1853, Lucy says nothing about having seen the golden plates. Even in a letter written to her that she writes to her brother Solomon Mack on January 6th of 1831, she does not mention handling the plates, nor does she mention the first vision, which is a different topic. And then in a letter by a woman named Sally Parker on August 26th of 1838, she says, I asked her, Lucy Smith, if she saw the plates. She said no. It was not for her to see them, but she hefted and handled them. And I believed all she said, for I lived by her 8 months and she was one of the best women. And so I'm just pointing out these things. So if Lucy's saying she never claims in during these writings that she saw the plates. In fact, she says she did not, she was not permitted to see them. So I guess I'm having problems with Henry Caswell. Is Henry Caswell lying or is Lucy lying at that moment that he thinks that she's lying? And then one thing I do notice is that there are certain apologetics. I just saw a video from Scripture Central where they also claim that they're like, Lucy may have even seen the plates. And this is the only account that I can find from Henry Caswell of her seeing the plates. So like, I don't know if I'm making sense. So it's just, none of those make any sense. So I don't.
So you're trying to determine whether Henry Caswell is lying, putting words in her mouth, saying that she claims something she never claimed so he can say that it was a bad claim.
Yeah, or like,
is she lying to him to try and bolster her claim and her status?
Right.
Because we've talked a lot about status in the past couple of episodes and how the status of these individuals to the people that believe them is beyond compare. So, you know, she's going to want to get in on some of that social capital of having seen the plates, etc. Possibly that could mm-hmm. be one motivation.
Yeah. Like, anyway, so just as pointing out that that there's problems here too with Lucy being a witness. So she does say that she handled and hefted them. And then there's the one of her having seen the plates.
I guess the point I just want to bring up that's coming to me is we talked about these other witnesses saying that we were going to share them just so people had the information about. And as I was listening to you give the accounts of Lucy and Mary and Emma and Josiah, I'm thinking, well, these don't seem like very reliable accounts, so it's not even really relevant necessarily to the church's truth claims until you show us this website page from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints website. because it's clearly saying who else saw the gold plates besides Joseph Smith. And it's, you know, listing all these extra witnesses as either seeing the gold plates or lifting them. And so what the church isn't doing, in my view, they're like I think Mike, I think this is the point Mike made earlier. They're name dropping these witnesses, the three, the eight, and the others, in ways that would lead members to believe that they add to the validity of Joseph's overall story. But what they're not doing is they're not communicating to us how problematic and unreliable their testimonies are. Is that fair?
I think you said that very well. Can you put that slide up again?
Yeah.
So the church at the very end, none of these 17 people ever denied what they saw and experienced. So if you like take those 17 people and kind of overlay like the problematic sources that we've been talking about, oh, Mary Whitmer was super late. She was almost 50 years too late. Some of the eight witnesses, they never even talk about seeing the plates. Or the three witnesses, they all said they saw it in a vision. Like the church does not give you those problems. They just say, oh, 17 people said that they were around, saw or handled the plates.
Got it.
And there as well, that's some slightly sneaky language where they say, no, these 70 people ever denied what they saw and experienced. It's like, well, actually only 13 of those saw the plates by the church's own reckoning. And then you've got the four that handled them. So again, there's just everything there is designed to make it as meta as possible, like as broad as possible. It's
right.
As inclusive as possible.
And they're talking about that specifically. They're not talking about their like testimony of Joseph Smith as a prophet or the church at all. Like they're just, yeah. So the church is wording that very carefully.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That's helpful.
Okay. So the next one is William Smith. And there's a few slides on him and as I was putting them in, what were you going to say something?
Oh, are you going to say who he is? Let's make sure.
So William Smith, I think he's Joseph Smith's younger brother. I don't know if he's the youngest, but he's one of the younger brothers. And he and Joseph often butted heads. It seems like he was very passionate or very William, like he's very stubborn, maybe is a good word. And I think he's the one that Joseph Smith and him would often get into fist fights. And then we'll see later on with his leaving the church and coming back to the church. Like he was part of the 12 apostles pretty early on. And then he was taken out of the apostleship and then he was placed back in. And then at Joseph Smith's death, he was taken back out. So he's got a hard relationship with the church. And then he later doesn't stick with the mainstream church. So that's William. And then William Smith. So there's three slides that I'm showing. And as I was typing them in here, you can tell that they're all the same. They're all the same experience because of the words that they're using and the way he's describing it. So this first one, in his own book called William Smith on Mormonism, published in 1833, William Smith relates. And does somebody want to read this, the quote?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Okay.
The story being noised abroad, he was pursued while on his way home with the plates by two persons who desired to obtain a possession of the plates to convert them into money. However, he escaped to the house and brought the plates with him, wrapped up in a tow frock. He could not permit us to see them because he said the angel told him not to do so, and he was determined to obey strictly this time, for he had disobeyed before and was compelled to wait 4 years before he could come into possession of the plates. In consequence of his vision and his having the golden plates and refusing to show them, a great persecution arose against the whole family, and he was compelled to remove into Pennsylvania with the plates, where he translated them. I was permitted to lift them as they laid in a pillowcase, but not see them, as it was contrary to the commandments he has received. They weighed about 60 pounds, according to the best of my judgment.
Perfect. So he's saying that Joseph Smith brought them home, and he brought them in a tow frock, which a frock is just a coat, and so they're probably just wrapped in a coat. And then he was able to, the story goes, I guess we can skip to the next one. So this next one is more details. So this one's 1883, and this next one is published in 1884. Again, another really late source. Joseph Smith received the plates in 1827. William doesn't talk about this at all until the 1880s. So in 1884, in the Saints Herald, William gave another testimony of handling the plates. Mike, do you want to read this one?
Yep. He says, when the plates were brought in, they were wrapped up in a tow frock. My father put them into a pillowcase. Father said, what, Joseph, can we not see them? No, I was disobedient the first time, but I intend to be faithful this time, for I was forbidden to show them until they were translated, but you can feel them. We handled them, the plates, and could tell what that we could tell what they were. They were not quite as large as this Bible. Could tell whether they were round or square. Could raise the leaves this way, raising a few leaves of the Bible before him. One could easily tell that they were not stone, hewn out to deceive, or even a block of wood. Being a mixture of gold and copper, they were much heavier than stone and very much heavier than wood.
So I just think this one's interesting because he's so that Joseph Smith Sr. puts them in a pillowcase, and then he says even in the pillowcase they were able to raise the leaves. So I just think that's really interesting, and he's describing them as being really heavy. He doesn't describe the thickness of it, but like it's hard to picture like handling the plates in a pillowcase, even though they're like parchment, as thick as parchment, as what Emma would say.
You kind of can, like, in terms of the ones that John's got. When I received my set and they were wrapped up in like a piece of linen or whatever, as you kind of pick them up, you can feel the leaves shift, and through the pillowcase you can kind of knock a couple of leaves up.
Well, I would like say that's the case with something that's the thickness of the ones that you guys have.
Yeah.
But as far as what Emma was describing, as pliable as paper or parchment.
So this is a problem between the two witnesses, not necessarily between his account, because by his account, if he'd got hold of what Joseph could have possibly made, then that's the experience he probably would have had. It's interesting that he mentions they're a mixture of gold and copper. That's, I've heard that theory bandied about, but I've never seen it in writing.
Tumbaga.
Or whatever. Yeah, like that.
Yeah. I wasn't saying that William was contradicting himself. It's just interesting, like, seeing his
versus Emma
and Martin Harris. Mm-hmm. So like, it's, yeah.
Can you remind me what Joseph did in 1824 to make it so he had to wait 4 years to get the plates?
Oh, why he was forbidden. The story goes that he's, was 1824 or 1823?
Oh, yeah, 1823.
Around there.
I think Joseph Smith first claimed to see the plates or to go to the place. Joseph Smith has a dream or a vision of where the plates are. And so he sees them in the woods, and then he goes there, and the angel's there. And Joseph, while he's about to get the plates out of the hole, he's thinking about selling them and making money. And the angel, if I remember correctly, it's been a while. But I think the angel forbids him, and the angel's like, you're not ready. You're too young. You're not thinking this in the sacred way that they need to be thought of. And so Joseph Smith says that he comes back every single year for the next 4 years. And then in 27, he's able to finally get them out of the ground and take them home, or take them into a hollow tree or something like that.
And I think in one of the years, doesn't he claim he digs them up, but then he takes his eye off them for 1 second, and then the treasure guardian kind of zaps them back in?
I feel like that was still the last time. I think the angel was trying to warn him, don't take your eyes off these. So I think that when he got them in 1827.
Yeah, because in the 1883 William Smith account, he said he was determined to obey strictly this time, for he had disobeyed before.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because as far as like letting people see it, no one else had seen it. So I don't really know
instruction that he disobeyed, I think is the question, right?
Right.
What did he disobey?
Yeah.
Also, I think this is interesting to me. I think Dan Vogel pointed this out, but on the morning that he gets them in the middle of the night, he's dressed in black. It's on the autumn equinox. So it's sort of a very cult situation. And when he gets them, he steals a man's horse. And I think he must be in a carriage because he's got Emma with him. And then the next morning, his dad has no clue where he is. His dad's like, oh, like, where is Joseph going to come out for breakfast? Because I usually eat breakfast with him. And they're like, oh, no, he's not here. And then the guest is like, my horse is gone. And then he goes in searching for the horse. Anyway, my point is that the family didn't even know that Joseph Smith was going to get the plates. But if this is a big thing for him to go every single year on this day, on the autumn equinox, to go meet with the angel, why is Joseph Smith Sr. and his family kind of confused about where he is on the morning that of this anniversary? Like, it's kind of confusing.
Yeah.
Unless it's Joseph goes out at night but is normally back by now sort of type thing.
Like, no, you mean, think that Joseph Smith Sr. would have a little bit more idea of what was going on.
Yeah.
Because Dan Vogel talks about that, where he talks about how the first year or two he goes, there's like an actual like kind of account of it. Then it doesn't seem like he goes again for a couple of years. Maybe he's doing the other treasure digging stuff. And to Julia's point, then when he does go again, it's almost like it's a surprise to his family. But like, it'd be kind of like if you were going every day on a day that's a magical, as Julia said, kind of like a culty kind of day. And then all of a sudden, like, they're like, well, where'd he go? It's like, well, you know where he went. He's been going every year. So it does show that that story was dropped and then picked back up.
Yeah.
Or at least indicates it, I should say.
Yeah. And another thing that's interesting is that in her book, Lucy Mack Smith says that Joseph Smith started telling stories from the Book of Mormon in 1823, which if you look at it in a sense of Joseph Smith himself wrote the Book of Mormon, that just gives him so many more years to come up with the content for the book. Yep. So, yeah.
Okay. That's okay.
Yeah. Okay. So we talked about him raising the leaves. And then, so in an interview with J.W. Peterson that he had with William Smith, it was recorded. He, William, said he had hefted the plates as they lay on the table, wrapped in an old frock or jacket, in which Joseph had brought them home, that he thumbed them through the cloth and ascertained that they were thin sheets of some kind of metal. When asked why he had not covered them, he said that they were told not to do so unless the Lord would give permission, that they were the property of an angel and had received strict commandments with regard to that matter. Brother Pender remarked that most people would have examined them anyway. The old man suddenly straightened up and looked intently at him and said, "The Lord knew he could trust Joseph. And as for the rest of the family, we had no desire to transgress the commandments of the Lord, but on the other hand, was exceeding anxious to do all that we were commanded to do." So this story is just interesting because he's saying that Joseph brought them home. They were wrapped in a jacket. And then he's like, "Why did you guys not look at the plates?" And then he's saying William Smith straightened up and he was like, "Look, dude, we knew that Joseph Smith, that the Lord could trust Joseph, and we were not going to break that trust. So we were not going to look at the plates." And so if you see this from like a magic worldview and you believe in guardian spirits, you believe in like devils and other things like that, that they did believe in, it kind of makes sense for them not to have seen, because they maybe really believed that Joseph Smith would be struck dead. So anyway, it's just another little bit of the perspective of the family.
Yeah.
And interesting. Mike and Nemo, any reactions to that?
I'll just throw out to tie this into our earlier episodes, that William Smith was one of the guys that was on trial for spiritual wifery, that Joseph Smith stood up in front of the trial and said, "If I hear one more word against my family, there will be blood on the curb or whatever, street or whatever." And all the charges were removed against William Smith while the other people got excommunicated. So, you know, William Smith had no problem violating the commandments in other areas, but you know, I just want to tie it into earlier episodes.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. And I think that's the reason why he was removed as an apostle. It was for his relationships with women.
Yeah. William Smith was doing that and telling women that he learned it from Joseph. So I'm sure he was, but that being said, when he got caught, he was spared while the other ones were not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got nothing to add to that.
Okay.
Okay, so this next one is Catherine. And I think Catherine is, I think, one of the most problematic of using her as a witness. So in 1945, Catherine's grandson, Herbert Salisbury, so Catherine married a Salisbury. Herbert remembered his grandmother relating. John, do you want to read this memory?
Yes. Catherine Smith Salisbury told me she was present at home when her brother, Joseph Smith, came in nearly exhausted, carrying the package of gold plates from which the Book of Mormon was translated. He was carrying the package clasped to his side with his left hand and arm, and his right hand was badly bruised from knocking down at least three men who had leaped at him from behind bushes or fences as he ran until out of breath. She said he entered the house running and threw himself on a couch, panting from his extraordinary exertion. She told me Joseph allowed her to heft the package, but not to see the gold plates, as the angel had forbidden him to show them at that period. She said they were very, very heavy. Again, I'm just going to say it's weird that he gets to allow a bunch of people to heft him, but they can't actually see him. It just, why? Why are so many people allowed to heft them, but they can't see them? Why?
Because they can't pass visual inspection.
Right. Well, yeah. And it's you can prove then that there is a physical object. That's what that's there to do, is there is something physical, tangible is there, because you've got these spiritual witnesses in the three witnesses who have been shown these things miraculously by spiritual eyes, but Joseph needs a way of testifying to people, proving to people that there were physical plates. But the problem is, like Mike said, they can't pass physical inspection. You know, the question would be, why are they just hefting them, not seeing them as well? Because then you've got the whole package, right? They've seen them physically and they've held them, like, but then, you know, that's too much. It's too much power. He's got to silo the different experiences in three people visually, in eight people physically or tangibly, so that he gets all of it, but you know, they don't work together, as it were. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting that when you put all these together, their little house seems to be really crowded with people, because you've got Josiah Stoll there, who I guess, so Catherine's saying that Joseph comes right in, he's out of breath, and he's got the package, and he sits down and he's kind of catching his breath from fighting off these three guys. So he's holding the plates, but then Josiah Stoll said that Joseph handed him the package, and he was able to see the green corner. And so it's just like, it's kind of confusing to know, like, who did Joseph Smith pass off the plates to? Like, what was happening here? Because Catherine's view is very different than what you hear from William, where it seems like a calm thing where his dad's like, he's just stuffs it in the pillowcase. He's like, can we not see the plates? And Joseph's like, no, we're not allowed to. And then Josiah Stoll who sees them. Anyway, so all the putting them all together kind of confuses what is actually happening that day that he brings the plates home.
I thought, wasn't one of the stories that someone had to make a box for it, like a wooden box, like that was supposed to have a lock on it, that Joseph was supposed to be able to just put it into when he got there?
I think Hiram, did Hiram get it from Willard Chase? Or he asked somebody to make a window like box?
Yeah, something like that. So I mean, like, that's why I'm like, why is it in a pillowcase? Because the whole point was having that box. Because Joseph Smith, remember, he leaves you know, we're told earlier he takes his eye off it and then they disappear. And now in this one, he's going to leave him in an empty log. And a hollowed out log, and then he leaves them there for days. I'm doing air quotes. And there's that story about Emma running in, and she's like, Joseph, people are going for the plates. And he pulls out his rock, he puts it in the hat, he's like, nope, plates are good. And so it's just, you know, the whole thing, this whole thing, like, it's so comical when you put it all together. And then now you've got Joseph running through the path from the where he hid the plates to his house, and these people decide they're gonna spread out and jump out of fences one at a time, like an action movie. And then apparently when they fail, they don't follow him to the house. They're just like, well, he got away. And they stomp on the ground and walk away. It's like, none of this adds up. So yeah, to your point, when you put it all together, it's just a complete mess that just tells you, it screams of somebody making up a story to try to give cover to all these other things that are happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you like try to put all this into a timeline, I don't think it would make very much sense. It's like, well, this person says that they got them first. And this person says that they handle them first. It's complicated.
Mm-hmm. I would love Catherine's an interview with one. Go ahead, Nemo.
As I said, Catherine's story sounds as though, you know, he comes in, he's exhausted on the couch, and she's allowed to pick them up and take them off him because he's so tired. Whereas Aristotle, like you said, is also claiming to be the first one that received them.
And as we keep going, you'll see that her account is a little bit different, even with itself.
Oh, okay.
You know, what would be a cool account would be as if we had an account for one of the three people that Joseph beat off. that's bad phrasing. One of the people that Joseph fought off when bringing the plates back to the house. Oh man, that's bad phrasing. But anyways, that would be a great account, as if someone said, I tried to... I'm done. Let me try this again. What would be great would be...
Mike's saying that it would be great if one of the three people that... supposedly attacked Joseph Smith had written an account. Today I tried to mug a bloke with gold plates in the woods and he ran away and I couldn't be bothered to chase him. Because that's what that account would read like, right?
He had supernatural speed and power.
But I didn't fancy using it in any way other than as a stick to beat a man with. I ran out of bullets or balls or whatever, the musket ball type things. You know, that's what that account would read like. Tried to rob a man, failed. Bad day for me.
Well, sorry, I guess I'm trying to say is everybody apparently at this time knows Joseph Smith is looking for these plates, right? I mean, that's kind of because he's a treasure digger, he's involved in the community. So all these other treasure diggers want this plate because they believe Joseph Smith, because they believe in this worldview. So that's why we apparently have three different people at three different points in this trail jumping out and going after him. And Joseph fights them off, you know, which we talked about in that episode, is just kind of, when you think about it, holding heavy plates, it's not happening. But you would think, because of the fact that it's such a well-known thing, that one of these people will be talking in the town like, yeah, we thought we had Joseph cornered, and he somehow, holding this massive hunk of metal, was able to fight me off and then fight the next guy in the fight. That dude's for real. But there, you know, I guess I'm just saying, like, you would think there'd be some sort of a thing where this would be documented if all of it happened outside of what Joseph tells everyone. Maybe it wouldn't be, because you wouldn't want to write down that you got beat up or anything, or that you got knocked over. But it just feels like everything that we get is from Joseph's perspective in mind, and all of those extra details are not corroborated anywhere.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's continue on.
So we continue with Herbert Salisbury.
Mm-hmm. So years later, in 1954, Catherine's grandson again shared the experience of his grandmother in an interview. And so I think this was like 9 years later. Nemo, do you want to read this one?
Yes, I do. Question. Mr. Salisbury, at one time I had a conversation with you in which you were kind enough to mention a testimony which your grandmother, Catherine Salisbury, gave to you in regard to the fact that the prophet did possess the place on which the Book of Mormon was translated. I wonder if you would be kind enough to tell us now on what occasion it was that she told you this story, where you were living at the time, and why did she relate this to you? Mr. Salisbury replied, Mr. Ball, I was then in my 45th year, as I remember it, and country surveyor of Hancock County, Illinois, and I was visiting my grandmother at her home in Hancock County, near Fountain Green, when I asked her for some recollections of her brother, the prophet Joseph Smith. Catherine Smith Salisbury then told me that while dusting up the room where the prophet had his study, she saw a package on the table containing the gold plates, on which was engraved the story of the Book of Mormon. She said she hefted those plates and found them very heavy, like gold, and also rippled her fingers at the edge of the plates and felt that they were separate metal plates and heard the tinkle of sound that they made. Well, hang on, which is it? Did she pick them up off Joseph when he collapsed on the couch, or did she find them dusting a room?
Right, and it gets more problematic too, but I also think it's interesting that, so he first tells the story in 1945 and then again in 1954, but he says, when he's recollecting it, he says, I was in my 54th year, and this is her grandson. So
45th year.
45th year. Is this, so he's saying, I didn't hear this story until I was 45 years old.
Yep.
So like, which is super interesting to me. So she doesn't start telling him the story until he's a grown man, like with kids of his own. Like, it just is interesting why, because like, at least with Mary Wimmer, they all say, her kids say that, oh, mom, we grew up with hearing her tell this story. But he's like, oh no, I was 45 years old when I heard that she hefted the plates. So I just think that's interesting. And then also the, like, John, you made this point last time where, like, how thick are the plates? Like, can you ripple them? She's even saying rippling them. And then like, William Smith can feel them through the pillowcase, and he says they sound like metal. Anyway, so it's, again, just confusing is what this is that they're looking at.
Very confusing and very improbable, with the fingers at the tinkling edges of the plates.
Right.
It sounds like one of those details that has been passed on almost through like the folklore of the people that believe in the Book of Mormon, whatever. So it's one of those that people feel the need to include in their story because it almost lends credibility. It's almost like it's a learned detail that witnesses all try and include so that they can sort of seem to be corroborated or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just like thinking about the metal on both sides that is thin that way that can be rippled. It's just doesn't.
And yet,
and you would
engraved and it's gold, and that technology didn't exist back then in Mesoamerica anyway.
And if you think about it, if you're trying to ripple something through a cloth, if they're that thin and you ripple them, the side of the cloth's going to get caught between the leaves and the metal, and it's not going to tinkle because it's going to deaden the sound. Just thinking practically, as your thumb goes up and applies pressure, it's going to push the folds of material in between those leaves as they separate. So they're not going to tinkle and fall back down on one another. They're going to go, because the little bit of cloth is going to get stuck in, right?
Yeah, there's just a lot of problems with that. Like, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it kind of fits if you have a prop set of thin tin. Like, I think it was Dan Vogel again who talked about how back then they use like these really thin pieces of tin to like secure barrels and to secure other things. And so that would be where Joseph Smith could easily get scrap tin. So if you stack those up and put them in a cloth, they would make that kind of, not maybe they wouldn't rustle maybe, but if you kind of picked them up, you could make them drop on each other and kind of give you that really thin kind of sound. Mm-hmm. Which, so to me, this makes some sense if Joseph Smith did make a prop set of plates, wraps it up in a cloth and says you can't look at it, but you can kind of play with it. And you would get some of that, but I'm sure they're exaggerating, like to Nemo's point, that you couldn't put your thumb like a book and just flip it. You'd have to kind of almost like pull the cloth off the side a bit and then just kind of play around with the different sheets of tin underneath. But yeah, it doesn't add up as far as to what Julia said to being thin enough to be written on both sides. It wouldn't make sense.
Right. Yeah.
Well, John's getting bored of this nonsense by now. That much has become clear.
I'm not bored. This is fascinating. This is groovy.
Okay, so this is a different story that we hear. And this one, so in the Saints Herald in 1954, so the same year as Herbert gave his little version. So Catherine's granddaughter, now Mary Salisbury Hancock, published this quote, it's called The Three Sisters of the Prophet Joseph Smith, in which she relayed this story. When Joseph was bringing the plates home from their hiding place to work on the translation, he was followed to father's house, to father's very door at one time by some men who were determined to get Joe Smith's gold plates, as they were called. Ever watchful for his brother's safety and hearing an unusual commotion outside, Catherine flew to the door and threw it open just as Joseph came rushing up, panting for breath. He thrust a bundle in her arms and in a gasping voice whispered hoarsely, get these quickly and hide them. Or take these quickly and hide them. Then he disappeared quickly into the darkness. Closing the door, Catherine ran hurriedly to the bedroom where she and Sophronia slept. Sophronia threw back the bedding and Catherine put the bundle on the bed, quickly replacing the bedding. Both of them lay down on the bed and pretended sleep. The mob, failing to find Joseph outside, returned to the house to search, but they did not disturb the girl since they appeared to be sleeping.
Wait, what? What? So, hang on. So we've had these where Joseph turns up and these men haven't followed him back to the house and he's gone and his dad's like, oh, well then let's have a look. And he's like, no, sorry. You can't have a look. And it's this kind of, he's brought this stuff back and everyone's wanting to have a piece. Then you've got him diving onto the couch and his sister taking them from him. Then you've got his sister finding him in the bedroom. Then you've got him thrusting them into his sister's arms. And then the mob somehow turns up. No one else has mentioned the fact that their house got raided by a mob. Like, right, and that's the sort of thing you write down, that then men broke in following Joseph into the house to try and find the place. Yeah.
Right, but also, well, as I was reading this, because like having heard the other accounts we just read, because she says when Joseph was bringing the plates from their hiding place, which one does she mean? Does she mean in Cumorah, where they were there for hundreds of years, or does she mean from the like hollowed out log in the forest? Like, mm-hmm. Does he bring them home a couple of times, or like, it's very confusing about what's happening here? Because like you were pointing out, like Josiah had them first. Joseph was on the couch and she picked them up, and like here he's rushing in the middle of the night and handing them to her, and then a mob comes in. And I don't think I've seen that anywhere else in Joseph Smith's in the history. I don't think I've seen any record of that. Mm. So it's her account coming from her grandkids is very confusing.
Some might say embellished.
Yeah.
Yeah, this certainly is embellished.
I think there's one account. It's oh my gosh, what's the other treasure digger that kind of almost dupes Joseph into adding the spectacles?
Samuel Lawrence, right?
And if I remember correctly, there's one story where Joseph is telling them, hey, be on the lookout for him because he knows I'm going out there. And I thought there was one story where they talk about how they had somebody outside of the house watching for them to make sure they didn't come to the house. But
Hiram was on the lookout?
It could have been Hiram, maybe. It was one of the brothers, I think.
There was a story later, I think, when Joseph was moving it around during the translation or during the time where he had them, because he has the plates for a while before he starts translating them.
Right.
And there was a time where he had them, he hid them in the hearth and then he removed them out. And then somebody, I think it might've been Samuel Lawrence, I can't remember who it was, but somebody came in with divining rods and they're like, oh, it's in the hearth. And so I guess it's sort of like, oh, divining rods work, but he had just moved them. So that's why they didn't actually work. Anyway, so that might've come from Samuel Lawrence, but anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to point some of the problems out with Catherine Smith's testimonies. So two earlier interviews were published during Catherine Smith's lifetime. One was published in the Saints Herald on May 1st of 1886. Here, she does not mention holding the plates, but shares the story of Joseph Smith obtaining the plates and reiterates her testimony of the gospel. The second one was published in the Kansas City Star on April 10th of 1895. She is quoted as telling the story of Joseph Smith and the golden plates, but nowhere does she mention hefting them. Joseph Smith obtained the plates on September 22nd of 1827. The first that we hear of Catherine hefting the plates doesn't happen until 1945, 45 years after her death. She passed away in February of 1900, and 118 years after the event of Joseph Smith obtaining the plates. So this is her hefting the plates is a very, very late account. And in my opinion, this might just be because it's so late, 118 years late, this makes room for me for fabrication or for embellishment.
Makes sense.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think hers is really problematic because, like, at least with the Whitmers, he says, oh, we grew up hearing this story, although it's weird that it wasn't published for 50 years. But, like, with Catherine, it's just a very late source is mm-hmm. the main gist of it.
Yeah. And that takes us to Lucy as the final witness we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, and it's just a really quick one. So the church does not see Lucy Harris as a witness at all because...
Who is this?
Oh, excuse me. This is Martin Harris's wife.
Okay.
So Martin Harris is one of the three, and Martin Harris, he did a lot of stuff to help fund the publication of the Book of Mormon. I think he sold his whole farm to help publish the book. So the church doesn't see her as a witness because it's not a real witness. It's a dream, or I guess you could say it's a real witness. But I'm including her in here because I think it's really interesting, and it gives me a moment to also talk about Martin Harris and his credibility. And then also her dream about seeing these plates is very reminiscent of the three witnesses and their vision that they have. So, because like from their own language, it doesn't seem like it was a physical experience. It was a dream or some kind of vision. And that's what hers is. So I'm going to include her anyway.
Can I just put something out there real quick?
Sure.
It's not surprising that the church doesn't want to put a lot of stock in Lucy Harris, given that she's the reason the 116 pages went missing. Like, she's not a favorable character in church history. So
she also didn't believe Martin's story, right?
Thought exactly.
It was a fraud. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
but also,
even they know that would be too difficult.
But also, her using her as a witness, then you have to believe everything that she says, or you that'd be
right. Well, this is my point, right? If you start opening that kind of worms that we're taking seriously the things Lucy Harris says, you then have to start. Well, I mean, you don't have to, because Mormon apologetics proves that you don't have to be consistent in your treatment of individuals as credible or non-credible. But one would think, looking into it, and perhaps this is where the decision comes from, the church doesn't want to mention this story because they don't want to open the case for examining Lucy Harris.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of how they don't ever want to talk about John C. Bennett, because mm-hmm. if talking about him and using his language at all is just opens up people to be introduced to John C. Bennett and everything mm-hmm. that was happening. Yeah. And like we'll talk about in this next episode that we do, Lucy Harris opens up the possibility of Martin Harris abusing her, cheating on her, and just being like a horrible person. And so that takes away credibility from Martin Harris, and they really need Martin Harris to be credible. And so that's another reason.
He's already doing a great job of his own accord, not looking particularly credible. So yeah, you don't want to add his wife into it.
Okay, so there's the account of her. So in Lucy Mack Smith's autobiography, she tells of an experience that Martin Harris's wife Lucy had concerning the golden plates. And this is only found in Lucy Mack Smith's autobiography. Lucy Harris didn't write it down herself at all. So she says, the next morning, soon after she arose, she related a very remarkable dream, which she said she had during the night. It ran about as follows. She said that a personage appeared to her, who told her that as she had disputed the servant of the Lord, meaning Martin or Joseph, either one, she didn't like either one, she said his word was not to be believed, and had also asked him many improper questions. She had done that which was not right in the sight of God, after which he said to her, behold, here are the plates, look upon them and believe. After giving us an account of her dream, she described the record or the plates very minutely. Then she told us that she had made up her mind in relation to the course which she intended to pursue, namely, that she had in her possession $28, which she received from her mother just before she died. while she was on her deathbed, and that Joseph should accept it. If he would, he might give his note, but he should certainly take it upon some terms. So I think she means like pay me back later. That's what I'm getting from it. So I wanted to point out that in Lucy's timeline of when the dream took place, Lucy Harris would have seen the plates before her husband had lost the 116 pages. And this would be also be before any of the other, the 3 or 8 witnesses had a view of the plates. And so it's interesting when Lucy says, she says that Mrs. Harris described the record very minutely, which is like very specifically. So she's describing the plates, I guess, in the same way the other witnesses are. Like she's not giving specifics, but she's like, and when I think of the plates, they're 6 by 8 by 4. Mm. And then, so she's saying Lucy Harris describes the plates very specifically before any of the witnesses have ever seen them. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that was interesting.
I think this is a way of trying to, after the fact, write Lucy Harris in as someone that ultimately came round, sort of thing. Like, because everyone knows she caused a problem with questioning what Martha Harris was up to and all that sort of stuff. But if you can claim that she had a miraculous witness of the Book of Mormon, then that puts her in the camp of, yeah, no, she got there eventually. And that's what strikes me as what's going on, particularly because this isn't in Lucy's own hand. This is being reported by Lucy Mack Smith. Mm-hmm. I don't know what your thoughts are.
What do you think, Mike?
I agree with Nemo. I think this is just what we see, you know, where Joseph Smith is kind of writing the history of the church after the other two witnesses are basically, actually all three witnesses are running out of town. And in this case, Lucy Mack Smith can write whatever she wants because Lucy Harris isn't around. Martin Harris isn't around. And it puts a really nice spin and a really faithful spin on all the people surrounding the Book of Mormon for those who are going to read this autobiography. And obviously the idea is to promote faith in Joseph Smith and in the church. So it makes sense.
Another thing that I noticed is that Lucy brings up money a lot in her autobiography. She talks about, even when she sees the breastplate, she's like, oh, that's probably worth $500. Or she gives some kind of dollar amount. And then she knows that Martin's giving them a lot of money. She asks money from other people and she's asking money from Lucy. And I think she's trying to make herself feel better, like about this, or like, oh, Lucy Harris had this vision and that's why she was able to give us $28, which was a lot of money back then. Mm-hmm. And so it's just interesting that how she's probably just trying to make it better for herself, or like trying to, like you said, make it seem like Lucy Harris is coming around to believing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Lucy Harris ultimately doesn't believe the story. And I know we've talked about this before, and I know in the Bible there's instances where people see miracles and they fall away. But if someone came to me and showed me plates in an angelic form, I'm not going to then turn around and believe Joseph Smith is making it up. So I think that's another area where there's just so many holes in this.
Yeah.
Righto.
Okay. Yeah. So we've got one slide.
Yeah. So this last slide, I think this is just the last slide. Yeah. So this I'm just throwing in here because I think it's interesting. So this is from Orson Pratt in the Deseret News, published on January 12th of 1859. So Orson Pratt's he was not a witness at all. He's not one of the three or not one of the eight. I think he's an apostle. But he says, upon each side of the leaves of these plates, there were fine engravings, which were stained with a black hard stain so as to make the letters more legible and easier to read. And so what I think is interesting is, to my knowledge of all the research that I've been doing, Orson Pratt is the only person to describe black stain on the plates. And so I just think that's interesting. It's like, where is he getting this information? No one else describes it at all.
It's a slightly sort of odd little practical detail, right? Yeah. It's almost like he's going, oh, okay, I'm imagining these plates, someone were to engrave them, they're very shiny, what would make them easy to read? I know, yeah, you'd put a black stain in it. So like, it's like he's kind of just going through what would need to, what is a possible, exception someone could take to the practicality of gold plates as a writing method or as a record keeping method. And he's trying to, you know, just explain some of that.
Yeah. It's just really interesting to me because like, where does he get this? Like he must've heard it from somebody because he didn't see the plates. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting. I also wonder, I don't know the answer to this, but if there have been any, like, have there been any ancient records found that have black hard stain on them? I think that'd be an interesting thing to see.
And also, do church depictions of the gold plates show them with some sort of darkening of the characters, or do they show the characters as, you know, the same sort of mirror finish as the rest of the the plate, etc. Because it would be interesting if this detail has made its way into sort of church art and video, etc.
Well, I mean,
such a small detail.
Well, church art is not very reliable, so.
No, but church art is based off things like this, right? Church art is based off the accounts and the stories and the tales,
right?
Of.
Well, so, other than the seer stone, but yeah, that was, sorry, it was sort of just a joke about.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's all the slides that we have. And then the next that we have is trying to go over the inconsistencies of the witnesses and what happened to the eight witnesses and these six or seven other witnesses, and whether they stayed with the church or not.
So, Mike, I know that you had mixed feelings about just covering the witnesses at all. Is there anything you gained from today, or that you insight you glean from today that you think is important or relevant to the overall mission of LDS discussions?
Well, I think it ties in. Like I said, I have said this a number of times in this series too. I think that the witnesses kind of give members who are believing a choose your own adventure, where you can kind of move around all of these problems and just stick with the statements that work with each other. And so I think the witnesses to a certain extent are, you could kind of go any way you want because of the fact it's an experience more so than a hard history. Like we talked about earlier in this episode, where to mention the first vision, the priesthood, the restoration, we have really good timelines as to how these stories evolved and changed. But where I like the witnesses is that it gives us insight into what's happening around the church. We talked about Hiram Page being one of the witnesses and having revelations on his seer stone. We talked about how some of these stories are late, very, very late appearing, and how they get grander, just like we talked about with the transfiguration of Brigham Young. So I think what's valuable is looking at the patterns, looking at the common threads, and how it fits into the things we've talked about in the previous 50 episodes. So I think it works well together. And I think after you do all all that initial groundwork, the witnesses give you a lot more flair, not just for that event, but how it kind of fits into the context. So I don't know if I'm making sense in that, because I still find the witnesses as a topic to not be terribly important to church history, just because of the fact it is an experience and not a historical data point. But I do think that you get a lot of info by really studying it and looking at the people who are involved and looking at the way Joseph Smith is kind of navigating them as to how he's doing other things as well. And I think that's where it's valuable to me.
Nemo, anything you want to add?
I just love that John's doing a Lucy Mack Smith on Mike as Lucy Harris. He's like, he spotted that Mike is the non-believer and Mike doesn't, he's not on board with covering the witnesses. So John's like, well, we got to find a way to paint him as, so we'll get there eventually. We've got to make sure that he's on board and on side. I've never really thought about the impact of covering the witnesses so much as the idea that these are meaningful to some people, and so this will be a meaningful thing for someone to deconstruct or to analyze in some way. You know, like some people will be basing a lot of their testimony, a lot of their belief system on the three witnesses. They will be using them as intended by Joseph Smith. They'll be using them as something to bolster their understanding of the events of the translation of the Book of Mormon or the reality of the gold plates. And for some people, it'll be incredibly important to dive deeper in. So, I think that's why, to me, they're important, is not necessarily from a historical point of view, but from the stock that some people put in them, that means that they then need to be addressed.
Yeah. For me, I'll just my final thoughts, and Julie, you can have the last word. What talking about these other witnesses sort of reinforces several points. Just the cast of characters around Joseph Smith just generally weren't very credible people. Today's episode kind of reconfirms that. It reconfirms that their stories, their accounts are sketchy. They're varying. And they're even contradictory, that they cast questions on the overall process. You know, again, like, why are so many allowed to touch it, but they can't see it? Why are they, you know, why can't they see it? And then why are their accounts contradicting? But then also, it just reinforcing this idea that the church feels very comfortable using people's accounts is selectively if it reinforces the story, but they do that often leaving out the problems and the contradictions, and in that way deprive their membership of true informed consent, so that you know, because it's pretty clear that if the church were to give all the information about all the different witnesses and all their varying and contradictory accounts, it probably wouldn't be faith confirming, it would be faith unraveling. That's what I got from today. Any last Agreed. Word? Yeah, you like that, Nemo? Mm-hmm. All right. Julie, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I just really like that. Going off of what you're saying, like, the church does a really good job of painting a really good picture. And they do that with these witnesses. They're like, oh, these three men saw it, these eight saw it, these six saw it, and none of them deny their testimony. And it kind of reminds me of, sorry to bring in media, but my daughter and I watch Is It Cake? And what they do is they make this cake that looks like something else, but they don't, when they have observers come in to say whether it's cake or not, but they have to stand at a really far distance, and then they have to assess which one is cake and which one's the real object. And so with this, it's like, if you stand back far enough and you kind of squint your eyes, everything looks like a great picture. But when you get close to it, you can see that there's a lot of problems, like you said, contradictions. These are late accounts. These are people with a very different worldview than the rest of us. Like, these people are not credible people. But if you take all that out, it looks great. But if you add it all in like you should, then it confuses and muddies everything else.
Can I just add something really quick to that, Julia? Because I think that is excellent. And I think that points to a broader pattern of behavior amongst the church, almost from its inception, is that they want you to look at everything from a macro point of view. They want you to look at everything as a broad overview, and they don't ever particularly want you to dive into the details of any specific thing, because it's once you do that that things stop working together. Because from an overview, 17 people that can all testify that these plates are real, some of them have seen them, some of them have lifted them, great, awesome, that's bolstering, that's great. But you start to look into the details of each of those people and what they say happened and how they interlink with one another, and that's how the whole thing starts to fall apart. So I think broadly the truth claims of the Mormon Church and the historicity of all these things relies on them all being siloed and contained individually away from each other. And that's what the church tried to do for years. And now they're trying to manage how those things come together, because they know they can't keep them apart forever anymore because of, well, the work of things like this and others that have gone before us.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why they have the gospel topics essays. To like keep them,
they get to manage how the things interact, because they know that if you let them just collide together, they break.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been an important set of pieces for the puzzle, Julia. As next time, we're going to have part four of the witnesses, as you mentioned, where we're going to talk about kind of what happened to all the witnesses, the ones that we haven't talked about already, and just kind of summarize all the contradictions. Is that right? Is that what's coming up?
Yeah. Figure out what happened to everybody and then the contradictions and stuff like that.
Okay. Well, thanks, Julia, for your contributions today. And Mike and Nemo, it's always great to have you as well. Please check out Mike's essays at ldsdiscussions.com. Please remember, you can see this entire library of episodes either on Spotify under LDS Discussions, Apple Podcasts, under LDS Discussions, wherever you consume your podcast, or if you want to see them in video, they're under a playlist called LDS Discussions on the Mormon Stories Podcast YouTube channel. Please check out Nemo the Mormon's YouTube channel. Because
all right.
Work and he's amazing. And also check out Julia's Analyzing Mormonism TikTok and Instagram. And you've got a YouTube channel too, right?
Julia? Yeah, it's the same title, yeah.
All right. Perfect. Well, thanks, everyone. And thanks to everyone for joining us today on Mormon Stories. We hope you're enjoying these episodes. We'll continue them for as long as people find value in them. And we'll look forward to seeing you all again soon. Thanks, everybody.